eyes and turned to Ms. Argent, who nervously flipped to a different page on her clipboard, cleared her throat, and began reading questions from a long list starting at the bottom. As promised, the questions were fairly straightforward, but to anyone unfamiliar with the case, they would have seemed like jokes and riddles. What were the strong man and the security guard doing in the prison elevator? Who hit the man in seersucker with the fake ambulance? How did the secret agent come to be in the courtyard with so many broken bones? Why did he seem so cheerful about it? What exactly happened to the salamander, the whisperer, the wheelchair, and the crane? These and several other questions Ms. Argent read with a straight face and an even, deliberate tone. Mr. Benedict listened attentively, looking thoroughly entertained. When she came to the end, he said, "All excellent questions, Ms. Argent. In response, allow me to offer a short narrative of the pertinent events. If you prefer, I shall start at the beginning rather than the end." "Oh, please do," said Miss Argent, and Mr. Gaines nodded brusquely. "Very well. The beginning is this. My brother's spies deceived your top advisors, the group of experts you conveniently summoned to Stonetown, Mr. Gaines, and were taking them to meet my brother at the prison, where he intended to use his whisperer to extract top-secret information from them. When we learned of this, my associates and I intercepted their vehicle, and Milligan and two of his sentries apprehended the spies, all of which I believe you know already. And when I informed your advisers of my brother's plot, they agreed it would be preferable for them to exit the vehicle and seek shelter beneath the highway overpass. Extreme haste was necessary in order to save the children, for if the van did not arrive on time, I believed my brother would grow suspicious and move to another secret location. Therefore, although Milligan sent instructions for several more agents to follow after us, we could not wait for them to organize their team. Our plan was for Milligan and his sentries to infiltrate the prison and bring the children back to the van. The rest of us were to wait at the van in our disguises. I've neglected to mention our disguises, but I assure you we looked quite dashing, pretending to be sentries ourselves. And thus, we hoped, staving off any reckless attacks on the part of the 10 men. Unfortunately, things went awry, and when Milligan did not communicate with us, his radio had been broken, Mucho and Miss Plug decided to go in after him. They managed to get to the roof with the intention of scouting the area, but McCracken arrived at the same time, and a struggle ensued. Eventually, Milligan intervened and secured them inside the elevator for their own protection, but his conflict with McCracken culminated in a fall from the roof into the courtyard. I believe this explains the broken bones. Miss Argent nodded without looking up from her clipboard. She was frantically taking notes. Mr. Gaines was studying Mr. Benedict with narrowed eyes, as if he suspected trickery and was intent upon discovering it. "Now then," Mr. Benedict continued, "during this time, Milligan's sentries were engaged with another 10 men, but they too were defeated, shocked unconscious, at which point Rhonda and Number 2 thought it necessary to enter the fray. I was still asleep at this time, but I believe it was Number 2 who hit the 10 man with the fake ambulance. Am I right, Number 2? "It would be more precise to say that he hit me," said Number 2 in a satisfied tone. "He was pursuing me at full tilt when I applied the brakes." Rhonda took advantage of his discomposure by securing him with a chain from his briefcase. "He was terribly annoyed," Rhonda put in. "What of the other 10 men, Mr. Gaines pressed. "Your report stated that Milligan's agents rounded up a baker's half-dozen, which we took to mean 7. Since that number corresponds to our own information, I must admonish you, Benedict, it's highly irregular and inappropriate language for an official report. So you did receive my report, Mr. Benedict said. Then, scratching his head with a puzzled expression, he asked, Why then have you asked all these questions? I'm certain I've already addressed them. You've addressed almost nothing, said Mr. Gaines, indignantly. For one thing, you hardly mention the children in the report, and in your so-called narrative just now, you've omitted their role entirely. Mr. Benedict raised an eyebrow. The children were kidnapped and held hostage, Mr. Gaines. That was their role in this affair. There is little to discuss. Indeed, now that I know you received my report, I see no point in continuing this conversation. The point, Mr. Gaines cried, is that you've left out important facts. How did you know about Curtin's plot, Benedict? How did you know about his spies? How did you know he was at the prison? And for the last time, what happened to the Whisperer? You seem to have something in mind already, said Mr. Benedict. Tell me, Mr. Gaines, what do you think happened to the Whisperer? Mr. Gaines leaped to his feet. I'll tell you what I think. I think you sabotaged it, Benedict. It didn't simply malfunction, as your report states. You purposely sabotaged it. But, Mr. Gaines, if I had sabotaged the Whisperer, wouldn't I have done so while it was still in my possession? Yet it was obviously functioning when my brother stole it. Otherwise, he wouldn't have arranged to bring your advisers to the prison. He couldn't possibly hope to get away with his plan without using the Whisperer, now could he? Mr. Gaines stomped his foot. You're playing tricks, Benedict. You keep evading my questions. Did you or did you not? Excuse me, said Mr. Benedict, for just then a telephone rang. The ring was muffled, but it clearly came from somewhere in the study. Mr. Benedict lifted a stack of papers and looked beneath it, then opened the top drawer of his desk. He frowned. I think it's in the bottom drawer, Rhonda murmured. Thank you, said Mr. Benedict, retrieving the telephone. He lifted a finger to indicate he would be with Mr. Gaines in a moment. Hello, this is Nicholas Benedict. Yes, certainly. Oh, no, not at all. Yes, he's here with me now. Mr. Benedict held out the telephone. For you, Mr. Gaines, it seems you're being removed from your post. Mr. Gaines blanched, opened and closed his mouth a few times, then reluctantly took the telephone. After listening a moment, he sat down again, and for some time he continued to listen, occasionally muttering dejected replies. Meanwhile, Mr. Benedict laced his fingers together and turned to address Miss Argent, who seemed uncertain what to do. Never fear, Miss Argent. The official reason for Mr. Gaines' dismissal is his filing of an erroneous report, the one concerning the smoldering wreckage my brother's men deposited in this house. That report wrongly suggested, as you know, that the Whisperer had been destroyed and that I was somehow responsible. The evidence has since repudiated this suggestion and supports your own report, in which you expressed a conviction that I was telling the truth. Thank you for that confidence, by the way. Also, allow me to offer you my congratulations. You're about to be promoted. Miss Argent's eyebrows shot up. Promoted? Indeed. Apparently, you're being given full responsibility for this case. By the time Mr. Gaines finished his telephone conversation, Miss Argent was sitting up straight in her seat, her shoulders squared with new confidence and a determined, eager look in her eyes. Mr. Gaines handed her the telephone without quite looking at her. I've been told to leave at once, Mr. Gaines mumbled, staring at his feet. Well, if you must, Mr. Benedict said, Rhonda will see you out. Would you like an aspirin or a glass of water first? You look unwell. No, thank you, muttered Mr. Gaines with a faint nod, and with Rhonda gripping his elbow, he shuffled out the door. Dismissal seems to suit him, Number Two observed. He's milder and more polite, at any rate. Miss Argent spoke on the telephone only for a minute, and was in Mr. Benedict's study only a few minutes more. She was closing the case immediately, she said. Any relevant paperwork would be delivered to Mr. Benedict to sign at his convenience. I'll draw the papers up myself, she concluded. I don't believe you'll find anything objectionable in them. Thank you, Miss Argent, said Mr. Benedict, shaking her hand. And now for more joyful matters. Our friend Mucho has prepared tea and cookies for a small celebration, if you'd care to join us. I'd be delighted, Miss Argent exclaimed, and for the first time anyone could remember, she smiled. What is the celebration for? Mr. Benedict pursed his lips. That's a reasonable question, Miss Argent, but I'm afraid... Now, which is it today, number two? We've had so many lately, I forget. Last week we celebrated the Whisperer's demise, and yesterday we celebrated Milligan's retirement from secret agent work. He means to spend more time with his daughter, Miss Argent, and to do so in one piece. But what is the occasion today, number two, do you remember? For shame, Mr. Benedict, scolded number two in a shocked tone. We're celebrating the discovery of the papers. I was only joking, said Mr. Benedict, laughing. Number two blinked at him, obviously baffled. You see, Miss Argent, we finally located the documents that will allow me to officially adopt Constance. It's truly a wonderful occasion. Why, that's marvelous, Mr. Benedict. Allow me to congratulate you. Thank you. Thank you, said Mr. Benedict, warmly, once again shaking her hand. You know your way to the dining room, don't you? Number two and I will be along in a moment. As soon as Miss Argent had gone out, Mr. Benedict turned toward the wall behind him and said, I thought we agreed there would be no more eavesdropping, children. Number two gasped indignantly and rapped on the wall with her knuckles. Honestly, children, how rude! After a brief silence, three muffled, contrite voices said they were sorry. I never agreed to any such thing, protested a fourth. Also, Mr. Benedict, I know perfectly well you made that joke just to get my goat. Well, said Mr. Benedict with a chuckle, perhaps I did. Some weeks after the incidents at Third Island Prison, and some days after the eavesdropping incident in Mr. Benedict's house, the young members of the mysterious Benedict Society paid their first visit to La Drop the Curtain. They were accompanied by Mr. Benedict, Rhonda Kazembe, and Number Two. But even so, they went reluctantly and with no small amount of misgivings. Only afterward, as they were riding away from the special high-security prison in which Mr. Curtin now resided, did they begin to feel good at all about the trip. You were right, Mr. Benedict, Kate said from the back seat of the station wagon. Things are much more pleasant when you stop being angry. I wonder if Mr. Curtin will ever figure that out. Mr. Benedict turned to smile at her. I'm curious myself, Kate. I do hope to find out eventually. Perhaps after 10 or 15 years of weekly visits, LaDropsa will turn the corner. Who knows? He may even be persuaded to use his talents for good. It would be far more rewarding than using them for nothing. I hope you aren't expecting me to go along on those visits, Constance grumbled. He didn't even accept the cookies. He threw them on the floor, and they were perfectly good cookies. You can decide for yourself whether to accompany me, Mr. Benedict said. You certainly needn't feel obligated. He isn't your brother, after all, though it's true he'll soon be your uncle. In any case, you'll be welcome to join me whenever you wish. That's true for all of you, I should add. Well, it was good to see SQ again, Rennie said. And I suppose he'll be there often. Did you hear him say he's been visiting every day, and that yesterday Mr. Curtin looked at him once without growling? That's progress, I guess, said Sticky, blinking exaggeratedly. He had just been prescribed contact lenses and was still getting used to them. His eyes constantly felt as if they had something in them, which of course they did, and without his glasses, his face felt as bald as his head. For a while, they talked about the 10 men, Mr. Precious and Mr. Bain, and all the other figures involved with Mr. Curtin, who had been taken into custody at last. And then, as they skirted Stonetown Harbor, they discussed Mr. Benedict's new project. He was studying his brother's tidal turbines with the aim of replicating them for the benefit of other cities. It was one of many projects he had planned now that Mr. Curtin and the Whisperer no longer occupied all his time and energy. "Speaking of time and energy," Constance said, "I've been wondering something, Mr. Benedict. Why didn't you just disable the Whisperer right away? I mean, once you learned it was going to be taken from you, why did you spend all that time in the basement, programming it to go kaput later?" Mr. Benedict hesitated a split second before saying, "To protect myself, Constance, Mr. Bain had private orders to check up on me, and on the Whisperer in particular, every day until the hour appointed for its removal. If he discovered it was no longer functioning, well, the situation at that time was delicate, and I might have been arrested for destroying government property." These remarks were followed by an uncomfortable silence. At least, it was uncomfortable for Rennie, who sensed that some things had gone unspoken, and that the adults were in secret conflict over it. He detected Number Two's look of disapproval, though she tried to conceal it, as well as Rhonda's impulse, barely checked, to add to what Mr. Benedict had said. "You did it for me," Constance cried suddenly. "But why would you try to hide that?" "Oh, there was no reason to go into it," Mr. Benedict said breezily. "It's true I didn't wish to disable the Whisperer until we'd had a chance to recover your memories. And then again, if I had been arrested, all the questions surrounding your adoption would only have grown more complicated." "But, Constance, my dear," he went on quickly when she began to ask another question, "you really must stop reading our minds without permission. Not only is it impolite, it is unwise. Think of all the surprise parties you'll ruin." "I wasn't trying to," Constance protested. "Sometimes it just happens." "It would happen less if you practiced," Number Two said irritably. She had shared her snack with Eskew Padalian and was suffering from it now. "Every day we sit down with you to work on it, and every day you refuse." "You're one to talk about refusing," Constance snipped. "After all this time, you still won't tell us your real name." This comment, which seemed to have come out of nowhere, prompted curious glances from the other children. Constance's eyes were squeezed tightly closed. Number Two had just begun to chide her for changing the subject when Constance's eyes popped open with a look of delight. "Pensilla!" she exclaimed triumphantly. "That's your name, Pensilla!" The other children gasped. So did Number Two. You set me up," cried Number Two, flustered and indignant. "You mentioned my name just so I'd think of it." "That was extremely inappropriate, Constance," said Rhonda, frowning at her in the rearview mirror. But to Number Two she murmured, "Still, it was about time they knew your given name." "Oh, I suppose, but it's just..." Number Two blushed and put a hand to her head. "It just doesn't feel right. It never has." "I think Pensilla is a perfectly lovely name," Kate declared. "Don't you, boys?" "I love it, Number Two," Rennie said. "Really, it's a great name." Sticky nodded. "Me too, I think it suits you." "Suits me? How do you mean?" said Number Two, knitting her brow. There was a tense pause. Rennie whispered into Sticky's ear. "Because it's pretty," Sticky said, and everyone immediately, emphatically agreed. That night, Mr. Benedict was sitting on the floor of his study, as was his habit when working alone, when there came a knock on his door. He contemplated the door before answering. In fact, he almost didn't, which was not his habit. But then he lowered his papers and said, "Come in, all of you." The children filed into the study. Rennie closed the door, and everyone sat on the floor around Mr. Benedict. Their expressions were serious. "I see we have something to discuss," Mr. Benedict said. "More than that," Kate said, "we have something to do." Constance pointed her finger at him. "I know why you didn't want to talk about the Whisperer today. You didn't want me to find out how close you were to finding a cure for your narcolepsy." Mr. Benedict considered a moment before replying. "Forgive me, my dear, but I was a bit embarrassed. I hope you can understand, with such urgent problems afoot, it seems selfish to have spent time working on what was at bottom a personal matter. But you're right, I was closer than I let on. I'm sorry for keeping it from you." "How close were you?" Constance demanded. "Exactly how close?" Mr. Benedict had looked apologetic. Now he looked resigned. "I see you already know the answer." He waved his hand carelessly. "It's really of no consequence, Constance. I'm more than used to living with my condition, and..." "You put it off," Constance cried. "You were only a few hours away, hours, but you didn't go through with it because of me. It's more complicated than... Don't try to explain it away. I've already gotten the whole truth from Rhonda and Number Two." "Not exactly with their permission," Sticky put in, with a significant look. Constance pressed on. "You thought it might exhaust you to try it, and so you didn't. You wanted to be alert and strong enough to deal with Mr. Precious and to help me recover my memories. You knew you were risking your opportunity. You knew you might lose it, but you put it off anyway because of me. You gave up your chance for my sake, and that's what you didn't want me to know about, because you didn't want me to feel bad about it." Mr. Benedict pursed his lips and said nothing for several moments. But at last, as all the children were staring at him, with the clear expectation of a truthful answer, he smiled somewhat ruefully and tapped his nose. Suddenly, Constance was all business. "That's all right," she said in a matter-of-fact tone. "I'll forgive you on one condition." She paused dramatically. "You let me try to fix your problem." "That's what I meant when I said... we have something to do," Kate said. "I gathered as much," Mr. Benedict said, and with a wondering expression, he looked from face to face. "And I see you are all determined that this should happen. But, Constance, you know I cannot possibly allow it. I am deeply touched. You must know that, but..." "You don't think I can do it," Constance snapped. Mr. Benedict frowned. "You're not sure how to answer," Rennie said, "because she has you trapped. If you do say that she can do it, she'll insist on trying. If you say that she can't, you'll be lying. She already knows you think she can do it. We've been talking about this all evening, Mr. Benedict." Mr. Benedict gave Rennie a helpless, ironic smile. "Thank you, Rennie, for clearing that up." "We know you don't want her to try it," Kate said, "because of how sick you think it will make her, and how, if it doesn't work, she'll have gone through all that misery for nothing. But she doesn't care, Mr. Benedict. She wants to try it anyway, and we want you to let her. That's why we're here," Sticky said, "for moral support. And we've agreed to take turns sitting with her all night to keep her company while she's so miserable." "I want to do this," Constance insisted. "Please let me try." "Please," Rennie said. "Pretty please," Kate said. "Beautiful please," Sticky said, then winced a little, for it had seemed wittier when he thought it than when he spoke it aloud. All of the children clasped their hands together pleadingly. Mr. Benedict looked at them, his bright green eyes shining. Then he fell asleep. When he woke up, there they were, still clasping their hands together and widening their eyes with exaggerated puppy-dog looks, and this time he laughed. He fell asleep twice more, and when he awoke the last time, he agreed to let Constance try. "You'll tell me exactly what to think," Constance said, "right? With your mind, I mean?" "Yes, my dear, and the thoughts will be fairly simple, but you will need to think them with as much intensity as you can manage." "That's what I figured," Constance said. "I'm ready to try." She swallowed dryly, thinking of the misery that would soon be upon her, but she did not flinch. "I think it will be best," Mr. Benedict said quietly, If you stared directly at me, do not close your eyes. Constance nodded and began to stare. Let's go. Mr. Benedict took a deep breath, relaxed his shoulders, and fixedly returned Constance's gaze. For 5 minutes and more, the two of them stared and stared. The others were reminded of a contest in which each person tries to get the other to laugh, but never had any of them seen two people gazing with such intensity. It was disconcerting, so much so they were tempted to look away, but they held still, afraid of causing distraction, until at last a look of frustration passed over Constance's face, and she broke off the stare with an irritated grunt. I don't feel like it's working. She thumped her fists against her knees. Somehow it doesn't feel strong enough. It isn't like it was the other times. Never fret, Mr. Benedict said gently. He seemed a bit relieved. Perhaps some day when... But Rennie, thinking back, felt a sudden flash of inspiration. Try getting angry, he suggested. Mr. Benedict lifted an eyebrow and glanced sidelong at Rennie. His lips twitched as if he were suppressing a smile. Angry at Mr. Benedict? Said Constance, with a helpless look. But I don't think I can. At the problem, Rennie said. Try getting angry at that. Angry, Constance repeated thoughtfully. She gave a tight, resolute nod. Okay, she said. I can do that. Let's try again, Mr. Benedict. Mr. Benedict's eyes twinkled, whether with amusement or anticipation, it was impossible to say. Perhaps it was both. And taking another deep breath, he folded his hands together and said, By all means, my dear, let us try again. They locked eyes, as they had done before. This time, however, Constance's face began to darken. She furrowed her brow, her lips pressed together, and her jaw began to clench and unclench. In moments, her face was the exact hue of a pomegranate. She was visibly trembling now. She looked not just angry, but furious. Indeed, had the others not known better, they would have thought she was ready to fly at Mr. Benedict and try to pull his hair out. And then abruptly, she stopped scowling and fell back. There, she gasped. That time I felt it. Putting a hand to her head, she looked hopefully at Mr. Benedict. Well? Mr. Benedict nodded and smiled. He reached forward and squeezed her hand. I am enormously proud of your courage and selflessness, Constance. Thank you, my dear. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I know you're proud of me, Constance said in an exasperated tone. But, she shuddered, the color had begun to drain from her face. Oh, no. Oh, no. Here it comes. Tell me quick, Mr. Benedict, did it work? I'm afraid I can't say, Constance. Not yet. But we'll know soon enough. Right now you should... No, I want to know now. Rennie, give him the poem, quick. Rennie was already unfolding a sheet of paper. He thrust it at Mr. Benedict. Constance wrote you a funny poem, he explained. She hoped you might use it as a sort of test. Constance groaned, crossed her arms tightly, and sank over onto her side. Mr. Benedict gazed at her with concern. Then he looked at the poem and read the title aloud. Why I Find Green Plaid So Annoying, and What I Intend to Do About It, An Explanation of My Heroic Actions. Mr. Benedict's lips jerked upward. He coughed into his hand, looked round at the older children, all of whom were grinning expectantly, and continued reading aloud from the first stanza. For one thing, plaid's hideous, a pattern cooked up by dimwit designers who must have been mad. It's also perfidious, a word I looked up. It means lots of different things, all of them bad. Mr. Benedict chuckled, then laughed outright. And as he went on reading the poem, he laughed again, and then again, until finally he was laughing so hard his shoulders were shaking, and he could hardly hold the paper still enough to read from it. The children began to giggle. Even normal laughter is contagious, and Mr. Benedict's high-pitched, chattering squeals, so very much like dolphin speech, were not only contagious, but funny in themselves. Even Constance, shivering and pale, managed to snicker through her moans. The giggles turned into laughter, and Mr. Benedict's laughs turned into guffaws and strange coyote-like yelps, and soon the laughter grew so uproarious it drew others to the study, so that eventually the room was packed with family and friends, with everyone laughing, though only a few knew why, and looking at everyone else with giddy, wondering expressions. Indeed, the laughter was so boisterous that it took a while for the newcomers to notice that Constance was not only laughing, but crying too, and that, in fact, she looked terribly ill, and that despite this, she kept gazing happily at Mr. Benedict, who had never laughed with such gusto for so long. The More Things Change. The time had almost come. The bags were packed, the early morning sunlight was growing stronger, and the children were gathered in Constance's room, eating doughnuts Kate had smuggled up from the kitchen. She had tapped on the boys' door as she passed, and a minute later they had come trudging groggily down the hall in their pajamas and slippers. Constance hadn't even risen, but sat munching her jelly roll in bed, heedless of the crumbs and jelly dropping onto her covers. It was a bittersweet moment. Everyone was excited, yet never again would it be so easy to convene a meeting of the mysterious Benedict Society. "I can't quite get over it," Kate was saying. "When I see Mr. Benedict walking around by himself without Number 2 or Rhonda hovering nearby, well, it's strange, isn't it? It's as if he didn't cast a shadow anymore." "Number 2 is having a hard time with it," Rennie said. "Every time he stands up, she does too, then sits down again, looking kind of disoriented." "It isn't just that," said Sticky, licking his fingers. "When I saw him in that blue blazer yesterday, with his hair so neatly combed, I had to do a double take. I thought he was someone else." "I don't like any of this as much as I thought I would," said Constance. "I really did hate that green plaid suit, but it's weird seeing him in other clothes. And Sticky used to drive me crazy, polishing his spectacles. But now I hate the way he's always wincing and squinting and running to the mirror to fix his contact lenses. And I couldn't wait for Kate to move out. But now that the day is here, the whole thing makes me grumpy." She frowned and wiped jelly from her chin with her pillow. "You're a sweetheart, Constance," said Kate, shaking her head. Rennie smiled and handed another doughnut to Sticky, who was glowering at Constance resentfully. "At least now we know what's making her grumpy. I used to think it was just how she was." "That isn't all of it," Constance whined. "I'm having writer's block, too. I've been trying to write a poem about all of this, the whole adventure, I mean, from the moment we met up to the very end, but I can't find the right words. I imagine it would be hard to come up with a rhyme for whisperer," Kate said absently. She was contemplating the empty space in her bucket. At the prison, she had recovered only a few of her lost items, and since then she'd been considering what should be replaced and what should be bidden farewell. Now seemed like the right time. There was only so much room in the bucket after all, and her needs might well be changing. Everything else was, wasn't it? "Rhyming isn't the problem," Constance protested. "It's the feeling. After all this time, after all we've been through and all we've accomplished, well, we should be thrilled, shouldn't we? We should be on top of the world. Mr. Curtin isn't a threat anymore, just a horrible old bore I may have to visit sometimes. And the Whisper's out of commission forever. It's all incredibly important, and yet it isn't that simple," Sticky finished for her, and everyone nodded because everyone understood. "I do wish things had worked out a bit differently," Kate said. "When I think of all the good Mr. Benedict could have done with the Whisper, all the people he might have helped, if only there hadn't been these other nastier people trying to get their hands on it for their own greedy purposes. But the Whisperer wouldn't even have existed if not for a nasty person with greedy purposes, Sticky pointed out. It's kind of disconcerting, isn't it? Exactly, Kate said. I keep thinking about how every good thing in this whole business has been completely tangled up with some bad thing. I mean, if not for Mr. Curtin and the Whisperer, we never would have met each other, much less become friends. And if not for Mr. Benedict, we might never have considered the good the Whisperer could do, so we wouldn't have been the least bit troubled to see it go. It's true, Sticky said. Everything has been bittersweet. Maybe we should acquire a taste for bittersweet, said Rennie with a grin. Then everything would feel wonderful. That's stupid, Constance snipped. If it felt wonderful, then it wouldn't be bittersweet, would it? Rennie only shrugged. He wasn't at all sure about that. Kate had wandered over to the window. Uh-oh, she said. Looks like it's starting. Constance humphed and covered her head with her sheets, but the boys joined Kate looking out. The courtyard was filled with adults. Mrs. Washington, in her wheelchair, was turning this way and that, directing traffic, and Mrs. Perumal was holding open the iron gate. Everyone else toted bags, boxes, furniture, and odd-shaped bundles. Mr. Benedict, wearing an unfortunate, huge collared shirt that Number Two had made for him, was carrying an ugly lamp that resembled a stork. Miss Perumal and Number Two were at opposite ends of a trunk, chatting and laughing, and behind them came Mucho Brazos, carrying a desk, two suitcases, and a bookshelf. Rhonda and Mr. Washington were out at the curb, adjusting a makeshift ramp for Mrs. Washington's wheelchair. And calling out encouragement from the bench beneath the elm tree was Milligan, both legs and one arm still in casts. Rennie's gaze lingered on poor Milligan. Not for the first time, he reflected upon his role in the events that led to those entries. It was Rennie, after all, who had suggested they go to the roof, and not long ago he would have felt terribly burdened by that. And yet, to his relief, he'd found that somehow his sympathy for Milligan was only that, sympathy, not guilt. "You aren't responsible for all of us," Kate had said in the prison. "We're all responsible for each other, right?" Evidently, her words had taken root in fertile soil, for despite the many problems that had remained to be dealt with, and despite his knowledge that new ones would always crop up, Rennie had never felt quite so light of step. It was an unexpected development, this new feeling, and remarkably pleasant. Indeed, he had felt so grateful for it that on the day Milligan came home from the hospital, he'd drawn Kate aside to thank her. "Good grief," Kate had cried. "Thank me? I just said the same stuff you're always saying to us. You should thank yourself." Then her expression had turned thoughtful. "But you know what? I'm glad you mentioned this, because I've been feeling guilty myself. I did sort of kick Milligan out of that elevator. He keeps reminding me that I was just trying to help him save Mucho and Miss Plug, but..." "We were all doing the best we could," Rennie said. "It's McCracken who should feel guilty, though I don't suppose he knows how." Instantly cheered, it never took much, Kate snorted. Maybe in prison he'll learn something about guilt and responsibility. "Maybe," Rennie said. He shrugged. "I did, I guess." Kate looked at him askance, then leaned to whisper in his ear, as if telling him a secret. "Yes, but you're smarter than he is, Rennie. Also, you're not evil." They had both laughed. They'd been in high spirits that day, and any little thing had set them tittering. Now, gazing down upon the moving day hubbub, Rennie smiled at the memory. How many times had they all laughed together, he wondered. Before Kate entered his life, before Sticky and Constance and Miss Perumal and all those people he loved down in the courtyard, before them, laughter had been in rather short supply. Rennie marveled to think of those days, they seemed so long ago now. He had had no idea what he was missing. "They're really hustling out there, aren't they?" Kate said. "It won't take long at this rate," Sticky sighed. "No," Kate agreed. "I think it took much longer to coordinate than it will to actually move. Rhonda has it all laid out like clockwork." "Has what laid out?" asked Constance from her bed. "The moving plan," Rennie said. "First, Dickie's family goes, then Alma, Patty, and me, then Kate, Milligan, and Mucho." "Don't say goes," Constance said, scowling. "I'm starting to get upset." The others exchanged private looks. For days now, Constance had been clamoring for the move, while the rest of them had spoken of it in more subdued tones. They were all pleased with the way things had developed, and yet they felt melancholy, too, for something they had grown used to was now changing forever. It came as no surprise that Constance had arrived at the same feeling rather late. Mr. Benedict had warned them it would happen that way, and had asked them to shore up their patience. "Fair enough," Rennie said. "Instead of goes, I'll say relocates. After all, Kate and I are only moving downstairs." "And I'm just moving across the street," Sticky said, sounding as if he didn't quite believe it. In fact, he almost didn't. He'd been in a perpetual state of surprise ever since the adults had announced this new arrangement. His friends had also been astonished. "Wait a minute," Rennie had asked. "You really were working on a project in the house across the street? I thought that was a cover story for Errand Day." "It was," Mrs. Washington had said. "But it was also technically true. In addition to the errands, we were renovating the house." "And Rennie and I are really staying, too?" Kate asked. "We're remodeling the bottom two floors," said Mr. Benedict. "If it suits everyone, the basement will be converted into apartments for you, Milligan, and Mucho, while the Paramalls will continue to occupy their rooms on the first floor. Rennie will move down the hall from them. Mr. Washington has some excellent ideas for a common sitting room, and—" "Are you serious?" Sticky interrupted, gazing earnestly at his parents. "I mean, can we really—" "Really?" Kate and Rennie echoed. "We really, really can?" The answer had been yes, they really could. After all, Miss Paramount had explained, it was an unusually felicitous arrangement. The adults would all be involved with Mr. Benedict's new projects, and to some extent, so would the children. It would be part of their education. The only remaining question was whether the children themselves approved. "Although we must confess it wasn't much of a question," Mr. Benedict had laughed as the children danced and shouted. The euphoria had lasted for days, and it still flashed upon all of them from time to time, though it had been tempered by the knowledge that the boys would no longer be roommates, that Kate would no longer be just down the hall, and that the regular meetings of the society might never again feel so urgent or important as they had in the past. Certainly it was a relief, but it was also, strangely, a kind of loss, and they all understood what Constance was feeling now. "Look, Constance," Sticky said in an effort to comfort her, "if you stand here at your window and I stand at mine across the street, we can send each other Morse code messages." "But I don't even have a flashlight," Constance exclaimed, and she began to cry. "You can have this one," Kate said quickly, reaching into her bucket, which she had banged back into shape. "Okay, Connie girl, don't cry. You take this one and I'll get a new one." "Can we still have our meetings here?" Constance asked, sniffling, and she peeked over at them out of the corners of her eyes. The others looked at one another. They knew that within a day or two, Constance's bedroom would be a horrific mess. They also knew that Constance's request was partly due to laziness. But no one cared to risk a tantrum right now. "We'll rotate," Rennie suggested. "Tonight's meeting can be here, Next time, we can meet in Kate's new room, and so on. But what will we even have to talk about? Constance wailed. There aren't any problems anymore. Oh, I'll bet we can find something to talk about, said Kate, grinning at the boys. Don't you? Like what? The stupid weather? Constance grumbled. She was no longer truly upset, but simply complaining out of habit. Why not? Rennie said, and he chuckled to himself, for just then he was feeling as happy as he ever had. It's going to be a beautiful day, Constance. It's springtime. And indeed, out along Mr. Benedict's fence, the roses were blooming. This is Delroy. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Mysterious Benedict Society and the Prisoner's Dilemma by Trenton Lee Stewart. This program was produced and directed by Janet Stark. Text copyright 2009 by Trenton Lee Stewart. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.